Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church, where God powerfully speaks through his means of grace. This is episode 38.
And as he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." So writes Mark. This is one of the most misunderstood and hard to interpret passages in the Bible. You can almost feel the excitement of the disciple turned tour guide. His attitude is like the exuberance of a child on Christmas Day as he points out the wonders of the temple buildings. I feel the same way when I bring my guests downtown to Chicago and point out the magnificent skyscrapers. The city is a part of who I am. However, my relation to Chicago is nothing compared to the first century Jews' relation to the temple. The Jewish nation's relationship to that temple was like a human's relationship to his own blood. Every aspect of their life was somehow connected to that temple in the magnificent royal city of Jerusalem. The idea that it would cease to exist was like saying the sun would stop heating the earth or that we need to grow gills and live underwater. It was just unthinkable. Why would the destruction of the temple be so devastating to the disciples? When would this take place and how does this affect Christians today? We will discuss these and other questions today on Theology Simply Profound.
Thank you for joining us today on Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Trullo. I'm the pastor here at Westminster Presbyterian Church, located at the corner of Wolf and Joliet Roads in Indian Head Park, Illinois. We're serving the western suburbs of Chicagoland. With me today, as always, is Rob McKenzie. He's an MDiv student at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, and he serves here as a ruling elder. It's good to be with you today, Rob.
It's great to be back up here. Not as much of a sauna as it has been.
But still a little hot. Yeah. A little warm. We're waiting for the fall to come here.
You really need to move your office to the basement. That would be helpful.
We'll have other problems that way.
It's true.
Well, we're back again to discuss Matthew 24.
No, you were about to say dispensationalism.
I was not.
You were about to say it. No. It was forming on your lips. It's been that long.
Matthew 24.
The Olivet Discourse.
Olivet Discourse. Really. It's found in Mark 13 as well, which you read from just a moment ago in the opener. And so Matthew 24,
that's
Mark
the main
13.
Passage.
Yeah. What's the main? It's the fullest.
Most people think about
it. It's the fullest.
Yeah.
And, as we approach it, it's on purpose after the dispensational series, because this is a main text for a lot of dispensational theology, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. This is an appendix in my book as well.
It's an appendix. How to deal with Matthew.
Yeah. Okay. Just how to approach it. It's a little more weighted on the... How do we as Reformed believers interpret this passage?
Okay. And so the context is that Jesus has come into the city. The triumphal entry happens back in chapter 21 of Matthew's gospel. And there's still the trials that are happening between Jesus and the Sadducees and Pharisees and so on and so forth. And then you have at the end of 23, you have this lament over Jerusalem that Jesus goes forth with. And O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, the city that kills its prophets and so on. And then we have chapter 24. You know, it's a famous Olivet Discourse, and you have the temple right in the forefront of things. And the question, I guess, a lot of people might have is, you know, why do they point out the temple at this time? You know, why are the disciples asking about it? They've been there before. It's part of their life, as you already said. What does it have to do with the triumphal entry that comes just a few chapters before?
It's interesting because, I mean, they had been. They had been growing up going to Jerusalem, going to the temple, all of them.
Yeah.
And here, you know, Jesus has said, "I'm going to Jerusalem to die." And he kept telling them that. And they kept saying, no, you're not. And, you know the famous passage with Peter where he is going to make sure Jesus does not die, and Jesus actually calls him Satan.
Right, Matthew 16. Yeah,
yeah. It leads up to this point that now one of the disciples says, "Look at these beautiful buildings," something he's already seen many mm-hmm. times. And I can only think that maybe they're still trying to, in some way, talk him out. I mean, he says we're going to Jerusalem to, and he's going to die. Then they have this beautiful ceremony as he comes in, and all the people are throwing down palm leaves and saying, "Here's our king, Hosanna, Hosanna, save now. He is our king," and they're ready to make him king. And the disciples are like, "Hey, you know, you don't really have to die. Look, all the people are with you. Look at these beautiful buildings. Look at Jerusalem. Look at this great place. Isn't it worth ruling over?" You know, it's a little bit of conjecture, but still there's something that makes them want to call the attention of the importance of the temple to Jesus.
Yeah, well, let's get that in front of us. So let's read the first few verses. What do we want? Through 14. So this is Matthew 24, 1 through 14. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death. And you will be hated by all the nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." All right. Passages before us. Temple takes prominent place right in the beginning. How do you think, Rob, is the best way to understand this passage as we're taking a look at that?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to understand the setting where they're by the temple, and when they ask them the questions, they go up on the Mount of Olives. So they're looking down on the temple, or they've got that kind of an angle. And so it's prominent, it's focused. They can see a lot of the city from where they're sitting. And in order for us to understand this discourse, there's three questions that are talked about in Matthew 24:3. And the three questions are just very important. The questions are, what signs will there be that indicate the coming of Jesus? When will the temple be destroyed? And when will the end of the age come? And I think to really understand this passage and the whole discourse, keep all three of these questions in mind whenever Jesus is talking. Because he doesn't take these questions and say, "Here's question one, here's your answer. Here's question two, here's your answer." He's always has all three of these questions in his mind. And so when he answers, he's answering all three, sometimes specifically one, but still he goes back and forth. He takes them as a group. And I think it's very important, again, to understand what he's saying. Jesus talks about warnings. I think it's good to focus on what he says is going to be happening. Because remember, all three of these questions he takes into play. So what are the warnings?
Well, you see, the warnings that Jesus gives the disciples are, well, to beware false Christs. Mm-hmm. He warns them of wars and rumors of wars. Kingdoms will rise up against kingdoms. He warns them of earthquakes, famines, devastations, upheaval. He tells them that this is the beginning of the birth pangs. It's that It's the tribulation of living in a fallen world in between the two advents of Christ. It's all of the nastiness of living in this age, as it's described by Paul, this present evil age.
Well, I think we also have to say that Jesus is talking to them. And they're going to be experienced. He's saying, here are the warnings. Watch out for false Christ. This has to have in some way, regardless of how else we're going to interpret this passage, this has to have personal impact on the people he's actually speaking to. And I think that's another very important key to understand this passage. He's speaking to the disciples. They ask the questions. They want answers. And he's giving them answers. So they are the answers are applicable to them.
Yeah, they are applicable to them. I mean, they're, the events that are here will happen in their lifetime, right?
Right.
Not necessarily exactly the way that some people might think that's going to happen. But in one way or another, the things that Jesus is speaking about will occur in their lifetime. There will be the devastation that comes upon Jerusalem in AD 70. There are kingdoms rising up against kingdoms in that time.
Right.
There are nations against nations.
There's earthquakes and famines and wars. And
just like the horrible things that we experience today as well. These things are there. And it really is to this, not cyclical, but this is the way it is. This is life in this
fallen
world.
Well, I think you can actually say cyclical. I think you can go that there are cycles of
Didn't want to get times. Native American. I mean, that's the cyclical life of, you know.
Well, that goes to the actual life forces of the earth and how it. No, I'm not saying that.
Right.
But I do think there are times within the world that we see greater activity of what we would call disasters.
Yeah.
And
I just don't want to put it in cyclical terms. It just ebbs and flows, and we just don't have a real way of telling what's happening when and how.
Right. Well, because we know that God is in control of all things, and yet we can still see this, that within history you have times of less dramatic devastation than other times.
Right. And in different varying parts of the earth.
Right.
And in different places, right?
I mean,
and at one time.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Right. One time you didn't know about them and they were happening.
Right.
Right. Right. Now, because of communication, we have the ability to know when and where these things are happening. Within a few minutes, earthquake that just happened in Italy. We knew about that right away.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have.
Right.
Except for modern advancements in technology. But the fact of the matter is that there's false teachers, and there were false teachers then, who would come after Christ during the disciples and the apostles, their time of ministry. And there are those today.
Yep.
And there have been throughout history that say that they are the Christ.
Well, there was a false teacher within their group, within the inner group that he's talking to right now, that would reveal himself by the end of the week. And, you know, I think something else that needs to be understood, because Jesus is answering these questions to these people, he's actually giving them comfort. He's saying, look, these things are going to happen. But you need to go preach the kingdom. I mean, he's pointing them to the sovereignty of God that, these things are going to happen, but you have a mission from God that you are to fulfill, and that's to preach the gospel.
Right. I mean, he refers to tribulation, verse 9, then they will deliver you up to tribulation. I mean, he's spoken about this way back in Matthew 5 on the Sermon on the Mount. And so it's not as though these things are brand new. It's not like these are special sayings that are different from things that Jesus has already said. You'll be hated by all the nations for my name's sake. He said that in the Sermon on the Mount, and now he's repeating it in a different context on the Mount of Olives. And then, you know, he moves into lawlessness, that love of many will grow cold. Well, you see that. You can even see that with regard to, you know, how Paul explains it in Romans 1, that suppression of the truth and unrighteousness will grow so much.
Yeah.
Right. That people will be given over to their sins. Well, there's a sense in which people, you know, they grow cold and given over to their sins because of just the amount of sin we see, the viciousness of humanity, in its fallen estate without a redeeming grace worked in their lives. And at times you see that increase.
Yeah.
Or you see at other times where God's restraining grace, common grace, we could call it, over humanity, pulls that back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Then he talks about these birth pangs or birth pains, doesn't he? Where's that at again? Verse 8, all these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Mm-hmm. What do you think about Ritterboss's comments on this? Mm-hmm. Let me just read this. He says, according to verse 8, however, such things are only the beginning of birth pains. This phrase, which is also common in Jewish apocalyptic writings, refers to the hard times that prophecy says will come at the end of the world as a prelude to the messianic kingdom. Such sufferings, indeed, must take place according to God's plan. But their beginning, however dreadful it may be, will not bring the end of at once. The disciples, therefore, must not lose their watchfulness and strength.
Yeah, well, I think this is why I was fine with calling it reciprocal, that the idea of, you know, it's being compared to a woman in labor,
yeah,
where you have a contraction, and then 10 minutes later you have another contraction, and then as you get closer to the birth, mm-hmm, the contractions start to come to the point where you actually can't tell. There's no time between them. And that's why we can see these times of great upheaval within the world, and then times of calm, and times of upheaval, and times of calm. And that, I believe, will continue until the return of Christ. And I think that's what he's referring to. So I think that's what Ritterboss is kind of getting to as well.
I think you're right. But wouldn't you say then, if that's what it's being compared to, you have these contractions, isn't there going to be this period of absolute distress where we'll know for certain that Jesus is returning?
Well, that's really interesting. In one sense, yes. Oh, yeah, we should. Look at all this great terror that's happening. Well, that just could be another contraction. That mm-hmm could be just another birth pain. And maybe that contraction is lasting a long time, and then it ends, and there's time of calm. But so we can't look at, our newspaper or the TV and say, look at all these great things that are happening, that are happening in the world. And so Jesus is going to return. And because of this earthquake in Italy, oh, that's a sign that Jesus is going to return. He's going to return tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, no, because we can always look back over history and see all these things that have happened, and Jesus hasn't returned yet. Who knows what you think this all this destruction would happen for, I don't know, 7 years, maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that. that
leads into obvious question, right? Yeah. We've been dealing with dispensationalism, mm-hmm, and the sense of looking at a newspaper or things of that nature to understand.
That really is what they do. Yeah.
To understand the signs of the times. How do our dispensationalist brethren understand this passage?
Well, they see this passage as being totally future.
Okay.
So, which was why one of the reasons why I brought up that we have to pay attention to who Jesus is talking to. That if this passage is totally future, he's not talking to his disciples right now. He's not talking to really anybody that's listening.
He's not answering their questions.
He's not answering their questions. He's not talking to us unless Jesus returns. If Jesus were to return right now, then we could say, yes, this passage applied to us. But, 100 years ago, the Christians that were alive then, this passage was not talking to them. So I think that it really, the fact that Jesus isn't actually responding to the disciples or other people, you have to reread the passage because he really seems to be. So with dispensationalists, they say this is what's going to happen right before the rapture and the tribulation period. And for them, one thing that's tips them off to why that this has to be is because they say with Matthew 24 that the disciples or whoever are going to be alive at that time, that the abomination of desolation has to happen. He talks about that. And in 24:15, he talks about that. And a Greek rendering of this is the abomination that causes desolation, mm-hmm, is what's coming out of there in the language. And the disciples are to look for that. And if when they see that, that's when the end is soon to come. Now, he doesn't say that happens at the end. He doesn't say that happens and it is the end. He says that happens and then the end will come. So it has to happen after that. Dispensationalists will say that the abomination of desolation actually happens 3.5 years into the tribulation period, when the Antichrist sets himself up in the temple as God. That's the abomination of desolations. Yeah. And then after that, so now the end's going to come, because mm-hmm. this is what the Antichrist has done. He stays there until, well, I mean, there's some things that happen, but really he kind of sets himself up there until the return of Christ. And so that's how they're looking at this. They're saying that these things will happen, then the rapture will happen, and then abomination of desolations, and then return of Christ. So that's their interpretation of this okay. passage, or the Olivet Discourse.
Okay. Well, I was looking at Ritterboss again. I thought he had a few good marks on this section of remarks on this section. So Ritterboss says in his commentary, this is on chapter 24, at verse 15, in the previous verses, referring to 1 through 14, Jesus has already spoken of persecution and distress as signs of the end of the world and the Lord's coming. Now he gives a special description of the distress that will accompany Jerusalem's fall, in which all the sufferings of the end times will come to a focus. Jesus' whole description of this is cast in an eschatological light. Jerusalem's destruction and the great distress that it brings are portrayed as signs of the Lord's coming and as images of the suffering of the last days. Here again, things that will prove to be separated by vast spans of time are compressed by mm-hmm. prophecy onto a single plane. And he quotes another commentator who wrote, "The events of the future are seen and portrayed without perspective. The catastrophe that will come upon Jerusalem and the catastrophic events at the end of the world coalesce into a single vision." I thought that was a great summary of these verses 15 through 28, because it brings in the destruction to Jerusalem and the Son of God's second coming, mm-hmm. right? And it puts them, in one vision. And which this is typical of prophetic prophecy, prophetic apocalyptic prophecy or prophetic literature of seeing, one of the illustrations is given. You see a small mountain and mm-hmm. then you see a large mountain behind it. It's hard to distinguish between the two from a distance. But as you get closer and closer, you see that there's a distance and a distinction and a distance even between those mountains. And that's one way to describe prophetic prophecy. And I think that's very helpful for us here, that the abomination that causes desolation is some, an event that takes place in Jerusalem mm-hmm. Within the next 40 years or so.
Right. Well, and I will say that for those listening, that this is something that is very mysterious when it comes to how do you interpret it. These sayings are hard sayings, and you're going to find many different interpretations. You'll find people that and where Bob and I stand are very much in the majority of the Reformed understanding of this, but you will find people that when Reformed that are strong commentarians that will say, I'm not going to touch this because they just don't want to have to get into it. And I think that, so don't take this easily, please. Those of you who are listening, go to these passages, read them and read some commentaries. This isn't going to be an easy understanding, and we're not saying we have all the answers, but I think what Ritterboss does is he really brings up a good point that Jesus is telling here's what's going to happen between now and the end of time.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to squish that all together in a 15-minute little lecture. it's hard, it should tell you why we don't understand exactly everything he's saying.
It's a conflation of time, which we're not used to doing.
Right.
We're very linear people in the way that we think.
Especially Americans.
And chronologically, we think about history and one step at a time. Mm-hmm. We don't think and talk in the way that Jesus is talking here. We don't say that I'll meet you at, 2 and intend on meeting a person at 4. It's just not the way that we're thinking and putting two events into one figure of mm-hmm. speech or into one prophecy, I guess is the best way to put it.
So I think this is why it's really important that we keep the three questions in our minds. That the three questions being, when will the temple be destroyed? What signs will there be to indicate the coming of Jesus, your coming? And when is the end of the age? Those mm-hmm. things, if you keep those three questions in mind as you're reading Jesus' answer, it really fits together a lot better.
Okay.
Because Jesus says, you know, that the abomination of desolation is going to happen, that you know, wars and rumors of wars. But he says at one point, the end is not yet. All these things are going to happen, the end is not yet. Because there's something that also has to happen before his actual return. And that is the preaching of the gospel has to go forth. That's kind of what Ritterboss was kind of hinting yep. at, talking mm-hmm. about, that this gospel has to go forth to all the nations. And so you're going to have wars and rumors of wars and famines, that the temple's going to be destroyed. The abomination of desolation is going to happen, but the end's not yet.
Right. And that's the verse 14.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And that's why, you know, that's why you always keep these three questions in mind. So until, as again, Ritterboss is saying, until the gospel has gone forth to the place where it ends. In other words, sometimes we say, when the last elect person is saved, Christ returns. And we don't know when that's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people I know that will say that as soon as we take the gospel to every single inch of the earth, or we meet all the people groups, and we're always trying to find these tribes that haven't been discovered for 2,000 years, or nobody knew about them forever. And then if we can go and evangelize them, well, then Jesus is going to return.
It'll unlock the key.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that. Because the gospel is going to keep going throughout the earth until Christ's kingdom is finished. Mm-hmm. And only Christ knows, only God the Father knows when that's going to be. And then Christ returns. But all the, you know, I think when people are interpreting this passage, a lot of times they take out that part. They focus so much on the destruction of Jerusalem or the abomination of desolations. And they separate out the fact that the key to his return is the gospel.
It's a proclamation of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's what they should be looking for.
Okay.
And it brings me, because I think we have to talk mm-hmm. about it within this context,
uh-oh.
Is preterism.
Uh-oh.
Because it's become very popular today, mm-hmm. or at least more popular than it used to be. So I'm going to throw it over to you. What do you think about preterism?
Preterism. Well, as we were chatting about before the... we turn the record button on. Preterism, to my knowledge, mm-hmm. has been considered a heresy.
Mm-hmm.
It's unorthodox. And the reason for that is because true preterism, in its essential form, says that everything that Jesus is talking about here occurs at 70 AD, mm-hmm. including his return.
Right. The second coming.
The second coming
right.
happens at 70 AD.
Right.
And if that is what preterism means, then that is a heresy.
Right.
Okay. But I think today, don't describe it that way.
Right. Just to be clear, that his second coming has happened at 70 AD, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's no third coming.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why it's very wrong.
Right. Well, that's why it's a heresy. Yeah,
there's no yeah. future hope. There's no resurrection of the dead. All those things are obliterated from yeah. from theological discourse.
Right.
It's a very strange in that form. Very strange to me to even think of it in any like that anyone yeah. would actually really believe it.
Yeah. And I interrupt you. You're going on about yeah. that. There's another form of preterism.
Well, yeah. As you do a quick internet search, you find lots of stuff. But you also find folk within the Reform camp who claim that they are preterists, but their definition of it is different,
mm-hmm.
and that definition is essentially a partial preterist. That would be those that say that some of what Jesus has done here or spoken of here in Matthew 24 has been accomplished in AD 70,
mm-hmm.
and that some will be accomplished at the end times
mm-hmm.
when in his second coming. So those are the two ways in which yeah. I've seen preterism spoken of. With regard to this passage, I mean, there's also with regard to the book of Revelation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I mean, just real quick with preterism itself, I mean, another reason why and I do consider it a cult.
Mm-hmm.
There's a preterist society that is full preterist, and they teach that our resurrection is a spiritual resurrection, and that's it. Christ has returned. Resurrection's already happened. And that's it. Then we're done. We need to, we need to seek to preach the gospel so other people experience the spiritual resurrection. And we want to see life getting better on the earth, but we're not looking for the return of Christ. And we're not even looking for our own resurrection.
Right. So no hope of the resurrection.
No hope of the resurrection.
Yeah. New heavens and new earth?
Apparently not. Yeah. No. This is it.
It has to be a great deal of neglect of many biblical texts in order to get there.
Yeah. But with partial preterism, this is why, things like this it frustrates me, where, there's a lot of people who are very close to all millennialists. I mean, they really are, and they still hold to a partial preterist view that all of this happened by 70 AD except the second coming. Mm-hmm. Now, they will talk about how Christ returns in the clouds at this point, in judgment, at 70 AD, that this was Christ returning in judgment.
I think, really?
Yeah. They will say this is Christ returning in judgment.
So a spiritual return on judgment on Jerusalem?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm as far as I'm understanding them, mm-hmm. and I don't get into preterism in the book just because did not want to go there. Or at least I don't think I talked about it. It's a big book. No. But it's frustrating me because now what you'll have with dispensationalists is they will just label all Reformed people as preterists. And they don't understand the difference between partial preterist and preterist. They just say, well, you're all preterist.
Yeah.
And of course that's a heresy. And so now we're all heretics. And they don't go to the trouble of first finding out that preterism in of itself is rejected by Reformed teaching as heresy. Partial preterism is a vast minority within Reformed theology, still Orthodox. Mm-hmm. Good, solid brothers in Christ and sisters in Christ are partial preterists. It's fine. But when dispensationalists label us like that, then it just adds to the confusion when we're trying to have, dialogue.
Right. If they think we're unorthodox to begin with.
Right. Well,
that we don't believe in a
resurrection or the second coming of Christ, and
there's a great deal of miscommunication that can only arise from that.
Yeah.
Well, about this preterism, partial preterism stuff, doesn't Jesus say toward the end of the Olivet Discourse, he says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away."
Yeah, it's interesting because this is I was talking before about how this is a mysterious passage, and this is one of the sticking points that kind of everybody kind of has a different, what exactly does Jesus mean here? And I don't think that we have a definitive, this is exactly what Jesus means here. I have what I believe he means, but I've heard some other explanations that are also plausible. For preterists, of course, they're saying that this is why the second coming has to happen at 70 AD, because he says this generation will not pass away till all these things are fulfilled.
Right, all these things.
Yeah, so that must be 70 AD when Jesus actually returns. The dispensationalists would say that this is why we know this is a future passage, because that generation passed away and these things weren't fulfilled. So there must be a future fulfillment. And so they say that's why, and we did talk about this in the dispensational series, where in 48, when Israel becomes a nation again, they say, prophetic clock has restarted.
Right, right.
This generation will not pass away till all these things are fulfilled. So then they said, 25 years. Mm-hmm. Said, no, it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, 40 years. Okay, 60 years, 80 years. And now they're saying, well, we must have, that marker must not have been what we needed, because Israel can be destroyed and reinstituted by God, and then the prophetic clock will be started again. Well, okay, there are some other explanations. How Reformed have kind of always understood this in a couple different ways. One is that this is actually talking about the generation of Israel, that Israel will always be here. Not Israel the nation, but Israel as a people group. So when Jesus returns, there still will be Israelites. There still will be Jews, and that's what it's referring to. Mm-hmm. Which I think it's fine as
plausible.
It's plausible. I think that it's actually talking about the generation of Christians. I think that's what it's referring to, that, you know, what generation? Well, the generation of those who believe upon the gospel, the sons of the kingdom, the you know, we talk about the good crops and the weeds, mm-hmm. and that, you know, the wheat and the tares. Well, the wheat is who it's talking about here. The, you know, the good fish that are in the net, that's what it's talking about.
Which in your estimation would include the disciples hearing this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So this generation will not pass away. In other words, those people who believe the gospel from what you teach will not pass away. We might be few at times. We might be greater at times. We might, but we'll always, God always has his remnant. Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to the Old Testament when God talks about his remnant. But again, this is my, what I believe it's saying. I think it's plausible. Mm-hmm. This is one of those that we just, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of authors have written on this, especially with regard to eschatology and the kingdom of God. Ritterboss has written on this. Mm-hmm. Voss has written on this. And trying to understand what it means for this generation not to pass away. Mm-hmm. Until all these things are fulfilled, and there's a variety of different views on that, and we don't need to be sticklers on it.
No,
but there are things that are out of purview,
right? And that's why with preterists we have to say no, that's heresy. Mm-hmm. That their interpretation is flat out wrong.
Right. Well, there's been in the past Schweitzer, Dodd, right?
Sure.
Where they say Jesus was just wrong.
Yeah.
He got it wrong. And we don't go there, obviously.
No.
Right? Because no, this generation that. Simply meant the disciples specifically and only.
Right.
And obviously, in their estimation, not everything was fulfilled. Ritterboss has a few comments on this, if you don't mind me.
No, go, again. Sure. Yeah.
He says, here again, we are confronted with the condensed and undifferentiated character of Jesus' portrayal of the future. The starting point for his whole speech was the coming destruction of the temple. Since from the perspective of prophecy, this event was telescoped with the Lord's great future, Jesus could say that the generation that witnessed the destruction of the temple would certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. He thus regarded the future in an undifferentiated manner. Later, in the light of fulfillment, it became evident that all these things would not come at once, and that they, therefore, would be seen only in part by the generation of Jesus' day. It's a slightly different interpretation of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. He's essentially saying that this is condensed, yeah. Just like the beginning prophecy, that we're seeing more than one event being spoken of in this prophetic words here.
Right. Well, I think we see this with Jesus when he prays in the garden before he goes to his crucifixion, where he says, you know, I don't pray for everyone. Mm-hmm. I pray for those who gave me, the disciples, and those who believe on the word. So you see that, you know, they're on their testimony, their word. And I think we see that capsulation of the people of God within that. And that's what I think
within that generation.
Here. Within that generation. Yeah.
Which goes to the way that you were thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we started this with the disciples looking at the temple saying, look, isn't this beautiful? And Jesus, you know, takes him, sits him down, and then just explains to him, look, this temple, this building, it's going to be destroyed. You're looking at it as you know, as I brought out, they're so connected to this building. They're so connected. Their whole life is there. And yet they're sitting with the true temple, and their life is going to be connected to him. And that's what matters. Mm-hmm. And that's what matters for us, that our lives are united with Christ. And all these things that we have going on in this world, earthquakes and terrorism and false Christ, false teaching, and we need to be aware of them. We need to help those who are caught in disasters. We need to look to God when we're caught in disasters. And we need to preach the gospel of the kingdom. That's what we've been commanded to do. But we should also find comfort knowing that these things must take place. But the end is the return of Christ. The end is the true temple coming back to us, who is more glorious than any building that can be constructed. Mm-hmm. That's the hope we have in this passage.
Yeah. And I was reminded in our discussion, we're going through the Gospel of Mark and Mark 13, mm-hmm. as you began and read from Mark 13, 1 and 2, speaks to us of the Olivet Discourse as well, the destruction of the temple. It's not as full, but in keeping with Mark's short sort of condensed version and what I think at least his focus on discipleship, mm-hmm. One thing that he brings to the fore in his discourse is this be on your guard. Mm-hmm. Be on your guard. It's over and over again throughout the Olivet Discourse. It's not just one time. And it's this sense in which, you know, you need to be on your guard now because these things are going on and are going to go on. Mm-hmm. And this is what's happening. And it all has to do with living as a disciple of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I found that very helpful when I was going through Mark for the very first time and understanding the Olivet Discourse from Mark's perspective as a disciple of Christ, one who needs to always be watchful, mm-hmm. right? Be on your guard. I thought that was very, at least pastorally to my own self, a helpful way of coming at the passage as a whole.
Yeah, it's really good.
Well, that brings us to a close for today, another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, find us online at www.westminsteropc.org. You can find us on Facebook. Just give a search for Theology Simply Profound. Or you can find us on Twitter at TheologySP. If you want to email us, we're at tsp@westminsteropc.org. We'd love to hear from you. And feel free to stop in and visit with us for worship on Sundays. Next time on Theology Simply Profound,
we're going to be talking about one of the most righteous men in the Bible, Lot.
Lot.
Yep.
For next time. Again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on Theology Simply Profound.